I've read several of your interviews in amazing guitar magazines, and so you've already been profiled and had a chance to speak your mind on musical things, but I still thought it'd be nice to have something for the radio.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I've been very obscure the last 15 years of my life, partly because I had a problem with my right hand on the guitar, and it's a problem that a lot of guitar players get when they get older. Some people call it focal dystonia. Mine, I just stopped playing, period, because it was the right hand, and I kept missing stuff all over the place. And then I've always had an interest in jazz, so I said, well, forget that. I've already done my recordings. So I can always go back to them and say, well, here's what I did, at least, you know. But I have an interest in jazz, and so I said, well, I'm going to try to become a better jazz improviser, which is pretty hard to do as an older person, especially when all the young guys can play rings around you and they don't really care for you to sit in with their groups and stuff too much. But, there's some good guys. I mean, like Bob Snyder was always a good guy. You know, he always sympathized with me. I started just doing the jazz thing and using a pick, which worked out pretty good for a while. At least it kept my hands on the guitar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And finally I started to say, well, I'm going to figure this thing out. I'm going to try to figure this thing out. And I really just took certain passages from pieces. What happened is look at it, I'm shaking. this is the A finger. I don't know whether you're familiar with guitar fingering at all or not. But it's P-I-M-A.
Okay.
And a few guitarists use the C finger, but it's pretty impractical because it's so short. So what happened is when I was using the I and the M, the A finger just go way back like this. I couldn't control it. It just fall back there. And then when I needed the A finger, I'd have to try to, not the whole hand, but get discombobulated and I'd screw up big time, you know. So I said, well, I'm just going to try to solve this problem. And I did it, and it's gotten a lot better. It's not automatic like it used to be. I mean, I still have to constantly think about that A finger. And I'm sort of halfway in the habit of keeping it out now. And I just keep working on it, and hey, what have I got to lose, you know? So I'm doing the classical thing again now. But unfortunately, even Segovia at 75 didn't play like he did at 55, you know. So.
And you bring up Segovia. That's an artist who has had a role in inspiring you from the beginning, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So there was a recording that you got when you were younger?
Yeah, my dad bought me. I was playing rock music and getting in all kinds of trouble in school and everything.
And this
typical
is here in
teenager,
Rochester, right?
Yeah, typical teenage rebellion kind of thing, you know. And I started playing guitar, and I had an old beat-up guitar. It was what they call a Stella guitar. It was the brand name Stella guitar, which is the cheapest one you could get. And I put some pickups on it, and I got some cheap pickups, and I tried to play rock guitar. I played a few Elvis songs and things like that, you know. And my parents were kind of horrified because my father played in the Philharmonic for a while, played viola, incidentally.
And so what years was he playing then? And what was
probably
his name?
Probably mid-50s. I'm not sure the exact dates, but it's, you know, somewhere around 55, 56, 57. And he was under Theodore Bloomfield. That was the, and he didn't get along with Bloomfield, so, which a lot of people didn't.
Those grand old music directors of yore.
Yeah, well. Anyway, he decided to leave the Philharmonic. He actually got fired, and the union got his job back. And it was just never the same after he got his job back. You know, it's terrible that you love music, and when sometimes things are really terrible situations that you get into. Anyway, so he ended up tuning pianos for the city school district. He made his living doing that after he worked in factories and stuff like that for a while.
Oh, wow. So, but music was still always around
there. Yeah,
then.
My mother was a piano teacher in the neighborhood, sort of a neighborhood piano teacher. And so my brother is a really fine flutist, and he writes music which is incomprehensible. He studied with Stockhausen for a while.
Oh, wow. Is he in the area? Or
no, he lives in Switzerland now. He's older than me. And it was an interesting situation when I look back on it. It was terrible when I was going through it, but he was like the firstborn. So he was the genius of the family, you know. And I said, I couldn't stand his music. I still have some problems with it. I appreciate the fact that he knows what he's doing, because I've listened to enough of it to know that he knows what he's doing. So I give him credit for that. And he's also a fine flutist, so he's really a good musician.
But so there you are, rocking out to Elvis on your Stella.
Yeah.
But then classical music kind of caught you by surprise.
Right? Yeah, well, Segovia inspired me. And I just couldn't believe, because back then there was nobody but Segovia. He was like the mentor for everybody who got into classical guitar. And he was wonderful. He played so expressively. I mean, still his recordings are top-notch. And he still inspires me. But the recording, I heard it, and I said, no, that can't be done. That you can't do all those voices and things. And I didn't care much for the classical music he was playing at first, because I'd heard it all my life, you know, and I was still in a sort of rebellion stage, but I just wanted to learn to play that kind of guitar so I could play rock better. But once I got into it, I got a little book. I went down to the old Levis Music Store. I don't know whether you've heard of that. And it was a big music store right across from, pretty much across from Eastman on Main Street. And I found a book, Learning the Classical Guitar. And it had tablature and it had the music with it. And I started to play a few little pieces from that book and got a little idea of the technique. And then I just went from there. I got some of the music of Sor, some of the little studies that he wrote. He wrote wonderful student pieces along with really fine etudes, you know, virtuoso etudes too. So I got the little book of Sor. I was already inspired by Sor because Sor was one of the people on the Segovia record that I got. He's one of the composers. So I was already inspired by that. And I was inspired by Segovia. And I just proceeded to teach myself for about a couple of years. And finally, I found a guy in Niagara Falls who was a student of Segovia. And so I'd make trips to make trips to Niagara Falls. And he got me, and I didn't use any nails. And if you know about how guitar players play, they all use nails. So I got to started using the nails. I ended up using them differently from the way John DeRose used them. And he didn't care as long as I got a good sound. And he said I was getting a good sound. So back then there was a big issue of, do you play like Segovia or do you play like Ida Presti or Alexander Lagoya? There were two schools of using the nails. And I ended up playing like Ida Presti.
Okay.
Who was a fantastic player, and I actually got a chance to study with her. She was just an unbelievable, wonderful player.
And as you were doing this, I mean, teaching yourself, but then finding teachers and then even getting in touch with these masters through classes and studies yourself, did you realize that this would become the main thing of your life, or had it sort of been a hobby that continued to take over?
It's always been a hobby, I have to say. It's aside from teaching for a living for a while that I was doing, it's been a hobby. Even when I was teaching for a living, I still had to do other stuff. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I mean, I was teaching at one time at Nazareth and Community College of the Finger Lakes and Roberts Wesleyan all together. And even then, I worked with a guy doing handiwork with him and stuff like that. So there's always been, it's never been, and I'm not, you know, this is what musicians go through a lot of times, so.
Well, and I think hobby is maybe the wrong term for, as I'm saying it, though. Even though you've had other work, it's been this sort of overriding passion of your life.
Yeah, it's a passion, definitely. Yeah.
And As you said, you heard a recording, and you also then studied with someone who had studied with Segovia, but you did actually get to meet him as well.
I studied with him, yeah, in 1966 in a master class in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
I know we're going back in all of these conversations, but would you be willing to talk about that experience a bit? I mean, to me, he's a name on recordings. He's a legend, but, you know.
Yeah, he was kind of before your time, I guess. I don't know how old you are, but.
most of what I listen to and play is, I guess, before my time.
So. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, that's the legacy of classical music. It's all old stuff that people like anyway. He was wonderful. And, you know, it was amazing to me how certain people got offended when he criticized their playing. And, I mean, I was asking him questions just to get his criticism, because I needed that. And he was wonderful. I mean, basically how he taught was he'd set an example and play it like that. You know, and he'd show you how he played it, show you how he fingered it, or he had a lot of additions with the fingerings and information on how to play it right in the additions. And so it was wonderful. He was always a gentleman with me. I mean, he was critical. I mean, I had a terrible technique when I started studying with him. I just didn't know what I was doing technically, you know. But I thought I was better than I was, as a lot of people do, you know. And he ended up signing papers that we had, you know, that we were studying with him. And he said, he wrote down, you must learn to study the notes more carefully, and you must really work on your technique. Something like that. I've lost the thing now. I don't know what happened to it in 6 moves since that time, you know. But basically, that was as much help as the actually working with him. Always a gentleman, always just as a kindly fellow, and he really was the king of the guitar from back then. You know, he just really was the master, and he still is really. I mean, he has an expressive way of playing that is just. I still am amazed at some of the things that he does and some of the effects he gets out of the guitar and the musicality of his performances. And it's a romantic style, which is something I love. And I play like that a lot, you know. But when it came to the late 70s, guitarists were all in denial of his style because they say he wasn't authentic. And they somehow thought they had a way to become authentic guitarists and playing Soar or Bach even Renaissance music authentically. And really, it turned out they were just sort of into a fidelity to the score kind of mentality and just playing what was on the score and not doing much expression with it and things like that. An awful lot of it was like that.
And it seems now that music's come around from, you know, the reaction to Romanticism to the historically informed extremes to now sort of integrating both kind of in a, or at least I'm hoping, I don't know if guitar is the same way, the sort of broader world of, say, playing Vivaldi concertos as a string player. Now I see modern groups taking on historical ideas or historical groups realizing, you know, that there's some value to the personal expression.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because how can you have any idea? And I mean, the problem is I learned to play from listening to Segovia, from studying with him and his students, you know. And I went down to Washington, D.C. to study with a fellow named Pappas, Sophocles Pappas. He was the only one around who knew the Segovia technique at all. But it turned out he wasn't much of a teacher. He was old at the time, you know. But I met other students of his, and we'd get together and talk about how to play this and talk about it, maybe play some duets together and things like that. So it was a good experience, and I learned a lot from that, you know.
And is that all of your training has been through these classes and through sort of, almost seems more like an apprenticeship model? Did you ever end up going to a music school?
No. That wasn't available at the time. Pappas was teaching an American university for a little while, But once I started studying with him, I said, well, I'm more advanced than he is now at this stage. And he tried to demonstrate stuff to me, and it was kind of not, didn't work out too well. And it didn't with all the students down there. They all sort of left him after a while, you know. So I ended up going to New York City after about a year and a half, 2 years of living in D.C. And here again, it was the infancy of the classical guitar back in the 50s and the 60s. And there really weren't many good players around. And I was not a very good player for a long time either, but I did finally take Segovia's thing to heart. And I was living in New York City, and I was teaching so much I didn't have time to practice just to make my living. I mean, so it was really pretty hard to do. I was teaching a lot of folk guitar and stuff like that, you know.
I was wondering if your students came from, that's if when you say 50s and 60s, I imagine everybody with a bit of a song in their heart was picking up a guitar of some sort.
Yeah, that was big guitar time, yeah. So there was always room for a teacher to make a living, and which was good. But I finally came to my senses and said, well, I talked to my parents about it, and they didn't really want me to go into music. They didn't, especially the guitar, they sort of didn't think much of that. Because they were from the old school that the guitar was not a good instrument. So even though they'd heard Segovia play and so forth, but they were of that old school that the guitar was not a good instrument, and Gershwin wasn't really good music, and a lot of things, and jazz was just a filthy thing.
Well, that's my viola teacher was much, much older, and he always told me to not go into musicology, to not go into early music. That was all, you know, for bad musicians.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I did all of it. Or nothing. Yeah.
That's good, though, you know. Musicology is a good field. I mean, yeah. If you can do it with some sense.
But, you know, there was this sense that I think he had played in the Chicago Symphony under Reiner. He was also a very old school.
So. Yeah. Well, my parents were very old school.
So did you end up interacting a lot with the sort of the village folk scene of that time then?
Well, I played in a place called the Night Owl. I don't know if you're from New York area, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm from New Jersey, but okay. More sheltered suburb girl. I like the city now.
Okay, well, I don't know whether it still exists, but there was a club there called the Night Owl. And I actually played classical sets there because I was one of the few classical people around. I mean, there were teachers who mostly from Latin America who were pretty good players, but even New York City, you didn't have virtuoso players around for the guitar at that time. There was very few. And so I got to make friends with some of them. I never ended up studying with any of them. I took a few lessons from this one, took a couple lessons from that one, and I ended up being friends, and I've had a couple of them saying, well, you actually play better than I play, you know. And just keep going in the same direction or something like that. And I didn't really play that well. I had a lot to learn. I mean, it was, you know, I was self-taught mainly. Even after I studied with Segovia, I was still pretty much self-taught, so.
Was it when you were in New York that you felt you ended up sort of sharpening up, or was it when you came back to Rochester then?
Well, I had to leave New York to come back to Rochester. I just couldn't handle the teaching 45 hours a week. And, you know, that teaching is pretty exhausting if you do it a lot. And even though I was young and I wasn't fully in love with teaching either. So actually when I was in Washington, I worked at the Library of Congress. That was much easier than teaching. So
must have been marvelous to be around all that stuff too, though.
Yeah, I actually met Barry Goldwater because I was working in the mailroom in the Library of Congress, and I took him a piece of mail in the Senate chambers. When he was a senator, I met him before he ran for president. So that's my legacy in Washington. That's the only important person I met in Washington.
So then when you came back to Rochester, you continued with the guitar, though, obviously?
Obviously, yeah. And I had pretty much freedom. I was living at home, which is kind of hard to do as an adult, but I knew what I wanted, you know, and I knew that, hey, my parents were the way they are, and they took me as I am, and I wanted to play the guitar, so they kind of went along with it. And so I did that, and I did a lot of practicing. I practiced sometimes 2 hours a day just practicing scales and things like that just to get my chops up.
And when did then, I mean, you mentioned that Fernando Sor was an interest of yours from the beginning, even with the Segovia recordings and then the Etudes, but when did you really start delving into his works pretty much more than anyone else has?
Probably in the early 70s, really. I mean, I just found myself playing more Sor than anything else. I still didn't have the idea of doing his works because he wasn't considered that good a composer back then. And really, the problem was that the guitarist from that period didn't really know how to express his music very well. And Segovia's attitude towards music was, he wanted to sell the guitar as a classical instrument, as a beautiful instrument. So he didn't play too many guitar composers. He played some Sor. He played some Tárrega and Giuliani and a few of the other classical who we now look at as masters of the guitar, you know. But his thing was, if he could play a Mendelssohn song without words and play it as beautifully as a keyboard player would play it, that really helped sell the guitar because it was a music people were familiar with. Or playing Bach, he played a lot of Bach on the guitar. And in his day, he played it in very romantic fashion, which Pablo Casals did too, you know. It was almost the style to play Bach like that. And I still love his Bach playing. But, you know, he sold the guitar as a classical instrument, and that's what he did. And he was like the foundation of the classical guitar repertoire. He got really good composers to write for it. And good composers, I mean, he never got like Bartok to write for it. And he never got Stravinsky to write for it. He got lesser composers who were more melodic and I think he knew what he was doing that because he had to have an audience. You know, when you're playing for an audience, you want to play something the audience is going to like. And he did a marvelous job. I mean, playing pieces by Castelnuovo Tedesco or Manuel Ponce or Villa-Lobos, and he played those composers marvelously. And so he really was, that was his mission, was to create a place for the guitar. He always said that. He wanted to see the guitar taught in conservatories.
And he succeeded.
He succeeded, yeah.
I mean, we have our classical guitar night and all these students from the Eastman School of Music that don't see themselves as different pretty much, I think, than a violin major or any other instrument now.
Yeah, it's marvelous. It's marvelous.
And intellectually, I can understand when you tell me that it wasn't respected by classical musicians decades ago, and I know this from history, but it's still because I love the guitar so much and because I see it as such a part of the classical world, just where I am generationally, it's still hard to feel that sense that, you know, to really imagine that people thought of it so differently, you know.
Yeah. It had to be sold, and I did my selling. I mean, I ended up teaching, like I said, and I was the first teacher in Rochester to teach at a college level. Of course, it didn't last long because I didn't have a degree, and the state kind of required that they had degreed people, at least, you know, to get money from the state. I think it's a money thing more than anything, so. Roberts Wesleyan held on to me for a long time.
And did you enjoy teaching then more in that context than when you'd been, burning yourself out in New York City there?
Definitely.
And around when was it that you started? We have these wonderful recordings of yours of the music of, should I say Fernando Sor or Fernand Sor, as I was reading your essay about his Catalan roots, right?
Well, everybody says Fernando Sor.
Actually,
Ferran Sors is the Catalan thing, the name, but he was not given a Catalan name. I mean, he was actually christened Fernando. And I think I understood why. I think I expressed that in the piece I wrote.
Yeah, in our thing online, I'll link to some of your essays because I think it's a marvelous way to dive into the sort of legacy of his music and to realize that, as you've written about that, there are a few pieces we know well, but there are so much more. Actually, if you'd be willing to pick, maybe we can pick one or two that you have recorded that are the lesser known ones that you think deserve more attention, and we can mix in some of the music with the interview to kind of connect people with
that. Sure. Well, his big works were not played very much. He was he was interesting in that he was a cusp composer between the classical era and the Romantic era. Some of his music sounds very much like Schubert and Mendelssohn, and which he was contemporary with. And still other of his music sounds like, you know, Haydn-esque music or Mozartian music. So he wrote a wonderful Fantasia. And it's like a 26-minute piece. It's the Fantasia Opus 16. It's on a theme by Paisiello. Mm-hmm. It was a common theme at the time. I think Beethoven actually wrote some variations on the theme, too. But Sors are better than Beethoven, I have to tell you. It was more extended, and it's really a marvelous set of variations and a beautiful introduction. A beautiful slow movement opens it up, and it's a marvelous piece. It really is. It's one of my favorite Sors pieces. And that, of course, is a long one, so I don't know whether you want to go for a long. You can find, just make up your mind. I mean, right from Opus 1 through Opus 59. It's all good stuff because he was mature when he started having his music published. So.
And he was a guitarist, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
And knew the instrument very well.
Obviously, yes. Yeah, he was probably composed the way he composed in a classical setting because the guitar is not a big instrument. You can't. I have a theory that the Romantic period came about largely because of the volume of the symphony orchestra as it evolved, and the volume of the keyboardist, the piano. The piano and the symphony orchestra really had a lot to do with all the extensive modulation and maybe more harsh chords that resolved more distantly that the Romantic period seemed to get into. I mean, I can't imagine, like Berlioz was a contemporary with Sors. Now, how could Sors compose like Berlioz, you know? How could you get volume or anything like that? And even in Beethoven, I mean, you find that Beethoven really used the keyboard as a volume kind of instrument and composed more lengthy, more dramatic pieces because of that.
And that was in his life and career that the instrument was changing, the metal reinforcement.
Right, exactly.
Which made it able to be something you hear more concertos with the orchestra. We have guitar and orchestra concertos, but it's always a strange kind of compromise when you try and play it somewhere
yes, it
big.
Is. It is, yes.
As I got to see the Concierto d'Aranjuez with Elliot Fisk in the Wheeling Symphony when I lived in West Virginia.
Ah.
And that was good. But even seeing he came and played, I think, that or something, maybe some Vivaldi with the RPO here, but I'm always wondering, will they use a microphone? How big will the hall be? It's not quite a natural fit.
No, it doesn't really work out too well, I don't think. I mean, the Concierto d'Aranjuez was like the biggest hit in modern classical music, practically, you know. And it's a wonderful piece, especially yeah. that second movement. I mean, it's just a wonderful, inspired piece.
Yeah. And that at least then I get spoiled being in radio by recordings because, of course, there's no worry about who's sticking out more because they've got it all worked
yeah,
out.
Yeah, they work that out with the... And that's part of the beauty of the modern day. I mean, I didn't have the money especially to go in all over the world and enter competitions or... They didn't even have competitions when I was young. You had to sort of go and follow Segovia around and study with him and follow maybe Aida Presti or Alexander Lagoya or Oscar Giglia around and study with these people and get recommendations and meet people in different areas and to get a career going. And I just didn't have the money to do that. I was born average, not... But most of the people who made it back then really had a lot of money behind them. And didn't have other responsibilities either. I got married in 1977. You know, I started having a family. I actually had stepchildren at the time and had to support a family. And that's how I ended up, you know, working at the bus company amongst other jobs.
Which that's we haven't even gotten to. So you drove buses here in Rochester, right?
Right.
I was just on the 47 this morning, I guess as people call it, who have heard that are the old 7, but...
Yeah, yeah.
So were you all over then driving and...
Yeah, well, I mean, you work there, I did a lot of overtime, so overtime I had to get all the different stuff. But I drove certain, you know, we had picks, union pick, mm-hmm. 3 times a year. And I'd get the one, I'd usually do night runs because I could carry a guitar with me, and they had long layovers at night, and I'd practice on the bus. And everybody knew it. I had some supervisors said I was carrying an audio device on the bus, and that was a rule they had. You weren't supposed to carry an audio device on the bus.
It wasn't exactly like you had a Walkman there.
Yeah, that's right. So he wrote me up for that, and I just had the union guy go in and kick the desk a little bit.
But you were able to still then continue to pursue the, you know, work with your recordings and your serious.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, it was a good job for one thing. I could make my own schedule on the job once I got enough seniority to do it. And that's what I did. You know, I mean, I figured out when I could get the most practice in. I carried a junky guitar on the bus, worked out all my fingerings and stuff. Got home and practiced it on a good guitar, and then I'd go out and record it, you know.
And, yeah, the system that you talked about, in some ways, at first as you described it, it sounds so much more romantic and exciting than the notion of going to music school these days, though as you bring up, there was also this big challenge that there wasn't support if you didn't already have it worked out.
Yeah, yeah, but that was pretty much how it had to be done. And like I say, I ended up teaching in college because there was nobody else here. And until they got somebody else coming on to Eastman, this is what happened at Roberts, too. I mean, the guy teaching is a very competent guy, but I didn't have the degree, and I was just told that without the degree they couldn't keep me on, which was an honest, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't mind it, especially since I was still driving the bus, you know.
So the recording project, you have talked about this in other interviews or written about it, but just a little bit while we're here, it's just fascinating. Did you find someone who wanted these recordings, or did you sort of start on your own? How did you take on? This is a big project that you have done.
Well, I decided that I love Soar's music above all other guitar music. Not really loved it more, but it was something that I felt should be done. So I started doing it, and then everybody started copying what I was doing. So there was a Japanese player named Kazuhito Yamashita. You might have heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he read through the stuff. You know, now how can you really get a feeling for music? But he read through it, and he was a really good sight reader and really a very technical player. And he went through it. But his were done in Japan and pretty much sold in Japan. Then a guy up in Toronto decided he wanted to record it, but he'd get all these different players. Nick Galusis was one of the players in that series, the Noxus series. And so it sort of, after I'd started it, it sort of mushroomed a little bit.
And then your recordings, though, did you record somewhere around here? Did you go somewhere to record?
Roberts Wesley and Cox Hall. And it was a beautiful hall. Back in the day, it was really good guitar hall. They did the hall. They put some acoustic stuff up in that hall eventually because they wanted it good for a piano, and the piano was too big for the hall. But for guitar, it was just a great hall. So that I had the acoustics of that hall. And I'd come out late at night. I started maybe 11 o'clock at night when most of the students were supposed to be in bed. And it was quiet. And I'd start recording, and some kids would be reveling a little bit, and I'd have to do that one over again. But, you know, I did it, you know. And I had my own equipment. I got my equipment by hit or miss, sort of. I got my recorder. Which was a Revox B77. It was a really beautiful quality recorder, 15-inch per second machine. I got that, believe it or not, because I used to work on Volkswagens. And so I'd buy an old junky Volkswagen for $200 and, you know, work on it and fix it up so you could drive it, and I'd drive it for a while, and then I'd get another one and fix it up and drive it for a while, and I had a couple of Volkswagens around. And I found out this guy and this girl, they were married, and he decided he didn't like her anymore, and he left her and took her car. But he also was a recording nut, and so he had this Revox B77. So I said, well, I got a car if you want it, but I need that Revox 77. So I got it.
So then once you had made the recordings and they were starting to get people's attention, I mean, these went out around the country, that these were being heard and you were interviewed in international guitar magazines.
Yeah.
What was this sort of like, seeing the feedback on the work that you loved so much getting out there?
Well, at first it was laughed at. Oh, there's only six good works. I had one review, which I could show you how to get it. I got it in a sort of secret place on my website because it's a terrible review, so I don't want people to read it too much. But this guy in England was really a very good guitarist, but he had the opinion that there were only six good works of Sore, and he actually listened to the ones he thought were good and that I was wasting my time doing the other stuff. And besides that, I was not a very good guitarist, and blah, 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 and I didn't have the proper expression for it, and blah, blah, blah. So that was the kind of thing that was happening to me more than less, until I got the guy in Guitar Player magazine who was really enthusiastic. What happened is I had made the tapes, and I read a review in Fanfare of a pianist named Santiago Rodriguez. Maybe you've heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just said, well, I'm going to find out where he lives. And so I did, and I sent him a copy of what I was doing. They were just forming their own recording company, the Elan Recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And Santiago listened to it and said, this is fantastic. He was very much into Hispanic music, and he was into the guitar a bit. And he said, this is fantastic. And so I got a call from his wife saying, you know, would you be interested in having some of your recordings? They loved the recording quality that I got, thanks to Robert Westing probably more than anything. But they loved the recording quality you got. We'll just take your recordings and put them on CD and sell them internationally. So sure enough, we did one recording, and it actually for that day it sold pretty well. It sold over, I think, 2,500 recordings internationally. So that's how this guy who interviewed me in Guitar Player knew who I was, because he actually bought a copy of the recording and liked it. And then he started reading some of the other reviews, and he says, no, this is not right. This is a good recording. So I've lost contact with him, but he was really a big help to me.
Well, that's just, it's must have been tough to confront, especially at the beginning, the negative things, but it sounds like you found the audience, or, you know, people found it eventually, the right people.
Well, to a degree. I mean, I still had it was just one CD out there. You know, and here I did 16 CDs of his music, you know. So, well, actually 15 CDs of his music. So most of it wasn't being listened to. But I put it on the website. I have my own website, as you're familiar. Mm-hmm. And I was actually selling them, and then I sold them as MP3 discs. Two MP3 discs for $20, basically. With all the Sore and some other stuff that I'd done, too. I specialized to a small degree in a Spanish Renaissance composer named Fuñana, who was a marvelous polyphonic composer from the 1500s.
And I need to get my hands on those recordings, because I found when I was reading, I saw references, and I don't know Fuñana's music at all.
Nobody does. Nobody does. It's marvelous, marvelous counterpoint, and, you know, polyphony is, you know. So anyway, well, I can get you them. I mean, yeah. I can show you how to get them off my website if you
okay.
want.
Okay, you know a guy?
Yeah.
So, and then do you also have your own compositions, right?
I've done some composing. You might have guessed by now that I don't really care for really far out modern stuff.
Mm-hmm.
even though I do respect my brotherhood. It took me a while to respect him, but I do respect what he did once I started listening to it and understanding that he really knew what he was doing. But I decided that I didn't like the whole direction of classical music. And, you know, past the Romantic period, you know, even some of Mahler's music is a little bit harsh to my ears. I love a lot of Mahler, too. Mm-hmm. But some of it gets a little harsh to my ears. And I started thinking about it. Well, what is modern music? Is it music that is written in modern times? Or is it music that is listened to in modern times? And I kind of decided, I'd read someplace that Beethoven was the biggest selling composer of all. Beethoven and maybe Mozart is, you know, behind him. And it wasn't a conscious decision. I just loved that music anyway. I mean, I think that period of music is from Bach right through Beethoven and Schubert is my favorite period of music. Mm-hmm. And so I just love that period of music. There's something fundamental about that tonality that was done and the way that it was moved around in the sonata form and the Haydn wrote some wonderful symphonies. You know, I listen to them all the time. And I love Beethoven. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do too. Okay.
Yeah. No, I end up listening to and falling in love with and in and out in love with so much being on the radio sort of so many hours now.
Yeah.
But Beethoven still remains.
Yeah, I mean, there's something, it's so fundamental. It's like earthy stuff that just is true. Mm-hmm. You know, once we accept the truth, we like the truth. Most people don't accept the truth in modern times. I've learned that. But so I ended up, I like pop music. I still like pop music. I always liked blues and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I put the two things together, blues and sort of Beethovenish. And it's on my website. You can listen to some of that.
And we'll link to that for the online version of this as well.
So I sort of did it and went over like a lead balloon, as I guess you could expect it to.
Well, you should bring some of your compositions to one of our open mics maybe too. I don't know. Well, and it's so funny that we think we're doing something new by bringing classical music to the bars and cafes. And then you tell me about being in New York City and we're not doing any, all these young people aren't doing anything new in some ways. People were doing that in New York City in the 50s and 60s.
Hey, listen, before I ever left Rochester, I was playing in a coffee house here. You know, I did it regularly. I wasn't much of a guitar player, but there was nobody else playing classical guitar, so it was kind of a novelty. And I played in I forget the name of the place even now, but it was on Court Street, which is now, there was a bookstore there, and right next to the bookstore was this coffee house. And I played there for a year or so. I was one of the regulars there, so.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to keep that spirit going, as you've seen probably with, you know, the little and
the spirit room. I love it.
So I guess just also some of what you're doing now, you said that you're back to classical guitar after some time away.
Yeah, I do the best I can. It's not like I don't play like I did at 55, but and I still have the issue with the right hand to a degree, so I miss a lot of notes here and there, but. And especially if it's a little cold, which I'm kind of worried about if I try to play.
Okay, otherwise we'll save a spot in, well, I don't know, when will it stop snowing? April, May? I want to keep doing that. But anything else that we didn't really get to or you wanted to add that you want to include in our conversation?
I don't know if you got any questions.
I think we've talked about a lot, I guess, you know, there's always just more. We've already talked for, I think, 45 minutes, and I could keep talking more.
Yeah, I could too.
But so perhaps we'll have to do a second installment at some point. But otherwise, I'm just glad to know you in the community and also
I'm glad to know you too. And I appreciate this because it's so hard to get anybody to do anything if you're not really well known. And I'm not connected to Eastman, so that's where the guitar scene is right now, is Eastman pretty much. But, and it's not like anybody's being nasty to me up there. I mean, since I've been going to guitar night and I actually played in one of the guitar nights, I've made a lot of friends amongst the guitar players there, and I've known Nick for years, and he's never been anything but very cordial to me. So,
Well, Lawrence Johnson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.